This is somewhere for us. An LGBTQ plus arts, culture, heritage and enterprise podcast for Scotland and beyond. We're celebrating and championing queer life in Scotland with or without the labels. I'll be bringing guests from page to podcast alongside our brilliant quarterly print and online magazine, also named Somewhere For Us, so you can get even closer to the content we feature. Visit somewhereforus.org to become a member and find out more. Welcome to episode 2 of the Somewhere For Us podcast, and in this episode, it's a bit of a double whammy with two special guests. I'll be chatting to Scottish lesbian writer Ellen Galford, author of Mull Cutpurse, Her True History, The Fires of Bride, Queendom Come, and The Dyke and the Dybbuk. Ellen is no stranger to recording stories. She was also involved in the Remember When project, an archive of oral history interviews, photographs and memorabilia, recording over half a century of LGBTQ plus life in Scotland's capital. And with us in conversation is Tim Puntis, a retired teacher and very active activist, championing the rights and well-being of older LGBTQ plus people. I feel pretty honoured to spend some time exploring the themes of love and pride, because this is Somewhere For Us.
Hiya, my name is Ellen Galford. I'm a writer. I'm a now relatively ancient lesbian, not just relatively, and in spite of an accent that sounds like I just got off the last plane from the States, I have actually been a Scottish lesbian for the last half century or so. I have written fiction. I've been involved in various activist and not so active aspects of Scottish lesbian life and Scottish Jewish life, and the two communities mysteriously overlap in interesting ways.
Hi, my name's Tim Puntis. I'm almost 70, so I've been around the block a few times, just like Ellen, and it's wonderful to be here. And I've been involved in LGBT plus activism all my life, and thank you very much for inviting me.
So here we are in my living room. I'm welcoming Ellen and Tim into what is now clean and tidy, but was ransacked by a toddler at 6 a.m. this morning. So thanks for taking the risk, and it's lovely to see you both.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. You're listening to Somewhere For Us podcast. I've known you both on and off through my community work, and I've never seen you in the same room together. So now it's proven you are different people. And you don't think you've met before in person, but you know a lot of people in common.
We have met before, but only.
We know a lot of people in common, or a lot of key people in common.
Oh, and people we love.
Like, yes.
Jamshed.
The late, great Jamshed.
So I invited you here to talk about pride and love. And I'm wondering what those words initially mean for you.
Well, the specific thing that I thought of immediately, I thought of the first Pride I went to in London in 79 with the great love who I had met just a couple of months before that, and who, knock wood, I am still with. It made me very thankful for the different kinds of love in my life, and sort of I began to think about, okay, there's the love of that you have with your lover, stroke partner, stroke whatever. I mean, I know there
whoever
are
you're stroking,
whatever
yeah.
you are calling your attached person, the love of the people in your family that you love, the friends that, particularly now when we've all been locked down for so long or being terribly careful about contacts, that kind of glow you get when you see somebody for the first time that you may be seen on Zoom or you've had a phone chat with, but you know, you realize about the connections and the different kinds of love there are. So yeah, I thought of that sort of love, and I also thought back to that trip down to London in, you know, a group of us, a bunch of the girls went down together for a London Pride in 79, and you know, I began to think of Pride marches over the next few years and how that evolved. I began to think of capital P Pride.
We'll come back to that. Tim, were you at that London Pride in 1979?
I actually was, yes. It was I think it might have been one of the last London Prides that I went on. I remember my first one was actually 1972, I think. I was less commonly seen on Pride marches in London after I came here in 1980. But, I'm talking about talking about pride is something that I find a really overwhelmingly happy thing to do, because it's when we think of what our community is like, I can take pride in all of that. I mean, let's start with the flag. The pride flag is just warms my heart so much, especially now, because, well, if you know the history of the Great Pride Flag.
I do, a little bit, yes. I'm sure you know a lot about it.
The story was that that Harvey Milk, who was the politician in San Francisco in the 60s, asked a guy called Gilbert White to make, Gilbert Baker rather, to make a flag. And he didn't really have any ideas and had a very short time scale. And what he ended up doing was to take material and take strips of it and sew it all together. So it didn't really have at that time any meaning. And it certainly didn't have the same colors. The colors were actually solidified to a certain extent by a commercial firm that started to make them. But Baker's own idea was that it should be changeable and, you know, adapt to circumstances and represent the entire community. And we've managed to keep that despite sort of the idea of solidifying the colors. And now when I see the lines for trans people and the lines for black and color, Asian people, it really lifts my heart and really makes me proud.
Remember, 20% of your membership goes straight into the Somewhere Arts and Culture Fund and the Somewhere Enterprise and Research Fund. Being a member puts you at the heart of Somewhere for Us, raising vital community funds, supporting queer creatives and businesses right across Scotland.
I think that that's something about our community, that it is so varied. We are so intersectional. We are so much part of so many other communities, and yet we come together. That's a real sense of pride for me, and the inclusivity, which I think maybe we still need to strive a bit more for, is something to be welcomed and to be proud about. But people who come out, we can be so proud of them. And people who don't come out, we can be proud of them too, because they're the ones, unlike us, who are not free of the burden of the closet. And maybe people have really good reasons for that. And look how strong they are to live that life.
For sure.
And how lucky we are to be free of that and live as ourselves.
And just that thing about saying about the flag, there's a lot of talking about adding colours, adding letters, and how it's so confusing and difficult. But actually the essence and the spirit of what Baker was trying to do with it was actually say that we are evolving, we are learning about ourselves all the time, and these colours can evolve, and the flag should evolve, and it has done it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, right. Embracing that is lovely, isn't it?
Absolutely right.
So let's talk about prides then. So when we talk about pride marches, what comes to mind for you, and what does it mean for you now as opposed to what it meant for you in 1979?
It's a kind of evolution. What I think of now, I think of the whole chain of them, of different kinds, when it was so crucially important to go, and then other times when I found myself pulling back. I mean, there's a kind of, in a way, a sequence. It's hard for me to think about pride now. I mean, I will say the last pride, it may be a symbol of aging that I thought about going on. I thought, well, I've got a kind of bad hip at the moment. There's always some crocky bit as you get older. And at that point, I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to do the actual march. I think it'll be coming through my neighborhood. I'll just go out and kind of join it about 2 minutes from home, having left out the previous 2.5 hours. But I guess the first Scottish pride is still something. It was a kind of lump in the throat pride. Because of the thing about having to go down in 79, there were no prides up here. I mean, there had been marches for various things. There was a famous march in the early 70s from, there had been a gay conference at the university, and they marched to the Scotsman to say, we are here, we exist. And you got that sort of thing, but it wasn't a formal pride. I mean, our first pride was 95.
I think so.
I mean, there had been demos, you know, there had been anti Clause 28 things, but the actual, and there'd been Lark in the Park, but as events, but the actual classic Pride March, we didn't have one here till 95, but then we also had a thing where men were, as it were, illegal in relationships so much longer than they had been down south of the border. So you had to take a trip if you wanted to go on Pride, but it was a big deal. People would get into the, somebody would hire a ghastly van, or you'd all be, far too many of you, jammed into, the bus or whatever. What my favorite early Pride, before that first Pride, I am on a Pride march. I have come out. I am out. And I didn't come out like 10 minutes after I got into my teens. I mean, I was really not properly out until very late in my 20s. Coming very close to 30 before I felt I am, out and proud and left what I would have described kind of compulsory heterosexuality behind me properly. So the excitement and the intoxication of that first Pride in London, and feeling really connected instead of guilty about not connecting, was such a huge thing. And it was, that sense of high excitement. And I remember my favorite London, my partner would be terribly embarrassed at this, but my favorite London Pride March, because of course you'd go on them regularly and it felt very important to be going on them. It wasn't just a fun thing. You went and it was sometimes still slightly scary. You had cops looking down from rooftops and you had a lot of surveillance and big conspicuous cameras and people were being photographed. This was the era of the miners' strike, of Thatcher, of all of that. There were some heavy and grim shadows. And yet there were times when it could be absolutely wonderful on a Pride March. We were on this London Pride March and I think my partner had decided, give me an L, L, whatever, shouting, give me an A, for lesbian. And then she actually got a little distracted. So she'd gone,
it's quite a long chant, isn't it?
Give me a B, B. And then she forgot the I. Give me an A. And then suddenly everybody practically stopped and said, huh, didn't you mean an I? And it was like 100 people around us were creasing themselves. Even there were police people.
Imagine how the
laughing.
Pansexuals feel.
Yes. we even got the cops to laugh. it was really very, that was a very funny one. But coming back up here and that first Pride March in 95, I just remember feeling, I think now back to, I thought of myself as a seasoned old veteran then. And, I look back on that, it was a long time ago, but that sense of being
just, so... Let me just pick up on that, Ellen.
Yeah, I've just jumped time-wise.
So, no, it's fine. Is there something about modern prides that do you feel involved in them? Do you feel part of them?
I think there was a point where I remember saying to various friends, it's kind of all about looking fabulous and this and that. Now, it's more of a kind of fun thing. And it's not that I'm against fun, for goodness sakes. But I felt it was kind of, I was going to it for the reasons that I suppose people in conventional, traditional societies, you had to go to church or whatever on a Sunday. You had to turn up at certain things. And that I suddenly realized I'm kind of bored on this and I'm turning up. But what am I turning up for? It was past... it was the point where a lot of things had loosened up in terms of life and legislation. The sense that you were there for a struggle or an affirmation, it seemed to be more about a kind of fashion contest and who's looking more fabulous. And that I might not feel, I've got to go on every Pride March. There was a sort of cusp where you absolutely had to. And then after that, it became a kind of recreational event. Then I remember going back, and not that long ago, I can't remember which atrocity it was. Was it...
Oh, in Orlando.
In Orlando, that's what it's for. Yeah. Suddenly you started thinking, okay, we've achieved a lot of things that were on the wish list. But at the same time, you suddenly felt there was that sense, okay, we're under threat again. I'm going out again. I'm going out for Pride March again. Political
you were
statement.
Propelled to get out
propelled
again.
To get out there. And I remember thinking, saying my partner and I were on this march. And, of course, Ellen used to say to me, my partner, who's also called Ellen, would say, you always treat all demos and marches like a cocktail party anyway, because you're always running into folk and gossiping. And, I said, well, that's part of it too. It is that sense of community and family and connection. But we were suddenly found ourselves sort of wedged in between the group from Lothian Police, Lothian Borders. These were the gay, it was the queer cops delegation. They were behind us, and the queer bankers from, I don't know which of the Halifax or Bank of Scotland. It was a very interesting sandwich. I thought, wait a minute, these used to be the enemy, remember? These used to be the bad guys. These used to be these used to be the Sheriff of Nottingham and we were the Robin Hoods, but we're all on this march together. And I felt this is amazing, but at the same time, I have to assess what's happening here because I'd always seen myself.
It is strange, isn't it?
It was very strange.
You can find yourself in front of HSBC and you're a bit like, oh, I mean, you know, and there's something about a Pride March. I don't know if you're hinting at this, but there's something about a Pride March and where you get placed on a march that's quite interesting. I ended up walking behind the Scouts once, and they all had T-shirts on that said, "We're fine with it."
That is a later era in history.
Which has never failed to make me laugh. The idea that it's like screaming panic at you. "It's all right. We're fine with it." Thank goodness. I mean,
That warms my heart that they did that. And I think
that's good.
If you see it in the context of, well, two things really. The Stonewall Get Over It campaign, it's a riposte, I think, to that. Well, we're fine about it. Now, other people can be as well.
That's also a nice reading of it, actually.
Also, it's in the context, I think, of the reaction to gay issues of the American scouting organizations, which were really evangelically run, really anti-gay, had acres of news space, both here and in podcasts, of course, and in other media, but principally in America, how rejecting they were of LGBT plus people in their organization, and they got rid of officers and things like that. So here we are. We're fine with it, says that the scouting movement here is fine with it, and it's a response.
It's an affirmative statement in response to that.
In response to that, and
thank
to
you
the...
for opening up my mind on that a little bit. That kind of reframes it a little bit. No, it's good. It's important to reframe ourselves sometimes, you know.
You're from a later era where you don't perhaps. You didn't have first-hand experience of the sense where there was an obligation to be secretive and discreet, and the sense of being, or it was an imagined obligation. I mean, I remember, because I had felt very happy to be out as soon as I had got it sorted in my own head, and boy, was I out. And I remember meeting, I was working in London, and there was a colleague from another branch of this particular huge publishing organization who we'd gotten on really well. Somebody said, I think he's one of yours. And we met at some work do, and we're having this lovely chat. And really, really got on. And somebody later on said, "Oh, I see you and David Thingmey from the Madrid office got on really well. Oh, that was nice." And then I met him later and he said, "You outed me." And I said, "What? Huh?" Well, somebody now knows I'm gay and I have not let, this was in the early, very beginning of the 80s. I didn't want people to know. And you and I were obviously getting on well, and maybe somebody even overheard we were having some sort of conversation that might have touched on those things. And I feel, you know, I feel my position in the organization is now kind of
compromised.
I felt really bad, really guilty. I hadn't been going around saying, "Did you know David Thingmey from the Madrid office?"
No, but you perhaps outed him because of who you are.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. I think that was possibly it. And, you know, and you suddenly remember there was a point where some of us were very deliberately wanting to be out and screamingly proud because we could, and others who felt endangered, who really were wanting to walk on the other side of the street. I mean, I, you know, loved the fact that I could dot my denim jacket with every badge going. And I mean, they've all been donated either to the, city archive or to, some of them to Glasgow Women's Library. But, you know, be wearing these badges, you know, "How dare you presume I'm heterosexual?" And, you know,
I bet we have a lot of the same badges.
Yeah. I've given it to Bob and Sigrid for the collection that they're making.
And I bet you didn't have a Lesbians Ignite badge.
I did, actually.
Oh, did you? Good for you. That was a very, very witty one.
If you like getting stuck into LGBTQ+ stories, you're going to love the Somewhere For Us magazine. Come and join us as a member, and you'll receive your copy of the magazine right through your front door. Exclusive collaborations, original interviews, beautiful illustrations, and your community at your fingertips.
Let's go back to what you said about being a teacher.
Yeah.
Can we touch on that for a minute?
Yeah.
Thinking about your memories of teaching under Section 28.
Yeah.
How did you find your community?
Well, the school that I was in at the moment was really quite kind of a very supportive environment. My own flat, which is just around the corner, had been attacked by local youths and so on. None of the children that I taught, I have to say. In fact, kids that had already left school, but the nature of my sexuality had been shared with them, and I became a victim. And the support that I got from my colleagues there at the time was really wonderful. I think the way that it impinged on me the most was that we all had to be very careful about not breaking the law, but we didn't really know how the law was going to be applied. And so we became our own teaching head policeman, if you know what I mean.
Self-censoring.
We had to self-censor. And that was very difficult. And of course, that continued all the way through Section 28, because there was never a test case on whether something was legal or not. So we were left guessing all the time. Some people tried to push the boundaries. Other people did exactly what they wanted. But there was this cloud of doubt and fear about getting yourself, getting the school into trouble inadvertently. And of course, there were lots of consequences from it. I mean, LGBT plus kids must, I'm sure, have felt very, very isolated. And of course, I was unaware of the sexuality of the kids. Just have to say that I didn't hide my sexuality from the kids, neither did I talk about it. And I made that decision at the time because I felt that the most important thing I could do was to be a good example and not to change the narrative to hate and difficulties and embarrassment of kids and things like that. So although I wasn't specifically out to the kids, which in a sense I regret, but it's not a regret that I didn't do it, it's a regret that I couldn't do it under those circumstances. And their needs were, I think, unmet often because of that.
I went to primary from the age of 1985, and then I left school going to university in 1998. So I was in school throughout that entire period that Section 28 was present, insidious and invisible, but very much there. And what strikes me about what you're saying in terms from a teacher's point of view of the self-censorship is that it's just how potent language became. And so I grew up feeling, having never been told overtly, but feeling very strongly that the words gay and lesbian were filthy words, like really, really sort of murky words, you know, that were going to really start a conversation that nobody wanted to have. You know, there was a discomfort around them. They kind of sat in the mouth wrong, you know. And when they started to be used as slurs and as kind of homophobic abuse in schools, I don't think people were actually thinking about homosexuals when they were saying those words. The words were so potent that they could just be powerfully like weaponized just by saying them without anyone actually thinking of gay people. They're thinking about the word lesbian and the potency of those words that weren't spoken in school. Yeah. Those words just had such a they were so difficult in that at that time. But I only know that now. I didn't know that at the time. I just suppressed it and then hated on myself internally, as you do with these things. And I wouldn't have known Section 28 existed at that time. I didn't even know it existed in 1998 when I left school. It's only now when I look back and I realise, oh my goodness, that's what it was doing.
I think this pinpoints in lots of things, Jules, but perhaps an awareness of our history is really important here. Talking about pride, that's another thing that we can be really, really proud of. My partner at the time and I used to stand outside Fire Island Disco in Prince's Street selling gay news. There was a lot of noise up the stairs above Watches of Switzerland and the thing that was going. And
can you just contextualise Fire Island for listeners?
Oh, of course, yeah. Heard me saying how
in case you don't know what Fire Island is, because it's important.
Fire Island was a gay disco on Prince's Street.
Prince's Street. Let's just take a moment to think about Prince's that. Street. Great.
It was a regular disco some of the time, but on a regular basis, it was a gay disco, and we would sell thanks to Bob gay news outside. for people going in. And I remember so clearly, I'm not really sure why it's so clear, but there was a heterosexual couple that came along the street. There was no one else around. They heard the music. They said, "Oh, is this a disco? Is it a good disco?" And I said, "It's a gay disco." And the only response they made was, "Oh, boke." And, you know, that kind of automatic, unthought of nastiness was, and I think still is, fairly common. It's just like you were saying, there is a sort of a seediness, an unfortunate disability of some kind that in being LGBT for some people. I'm sure that still exists, although thank God it's waning in importance and doesn't seem to apply to the younger generations.
I don't want to gloss over the fact, Ellen, that you went to a Pride with your current partner in 1979.
Aye.
And you were 2 months in, did you say, into your relationship?
Yeah. Well, you know, there was an old joke.
I want to hear about how it felt to walk on a Pride march with your new relationship.
Well, it was pretty fabulous.
You're blushing.
No, it was. Things happened fast. And in fact, there was certainly, even then, there was a joke about what does a lesbian bring on the second date? A removal van.
A U-Haul, wasn't it?
Yes. And, you know, we did. In fact, somebody once said years later, a heterosexual acquaintance or friend said, you know, we said, "Oh, you know, we're going out tomorrow night. It's our whatever, you know, 20th anniversary or something like that." And they sort of were off, said, "I hope you don't mind my asking, but this was before civil partnership, before, you know, 20th anniversary of what? In, you know, what? Which bit do you actually, you know, is it when you met? Is it when you kind of got it together? Is it when you moved in together?" You know, and we said, "Well, it was all kind of a very quick blur, really."
You're like, "Yes, it was that weekend."
Yeah,
yes.
It was that weekend. Yeah. I mean, we met in April. We were certainly off together on the Pride March in, I guess it was June. That would have been, yes. And then we came back, then we moved together down to London in, around September. And so I think both of us, we thought at first about moving in together in, you know, she was a Ouija, she was from Glasgow, and I had lived in both Glasgow and Edinburgh, but I was an Edinburgh person again by that time. And we thought it's time we move, let's live together. We said, "Do you think we could get a mortgage together?" So we went to an estate agent or something in Byers Road and said, "We would, you know, they also did mortgages." We said, we really want to buy a house together or a flat together or something. Could we get, you know, could we have a joint mortgage?" And he sort of looked and said, "I'm sorry, only people who are related to each other can have mortgages, joint mortgages, if they're not actually married." And of course, you couldn't be married. And so I reached out and grabbed her sitting next to me, hand to hand, said, "We were late all the time." And this guy got very, very pale.
Just and finished relating, actually.
So in between deciding to do it in June and moving down to, in September, Thatcher had been elected. Mm-hmm. And you could hear the dark roll of the drums in the background as things were going to start getting a little less loose and free and easy in a lot of ways for a lot of people. But so it all happened within a period of a few months. So that first London Pride was, we didn't know what was going to happen with us. We didn't know what was going to happen with anything. But, you know, things were just on a cusp. It was a real turning point. That year, 79, you know, the spring and summer of 79, I mean, they were personally crucial, but I think they were also politically crucial for what was about to start unfolding in terms of UK politics, in terms of the lives and deaths.
I'm also thinking about that. I was going to say, thinking about the health of the community at the time.
The health of the community. Well, we were just
HIV and AIDS.
That was
impacting.
A little ahead of us still at that point, but it was just about to, you know, by the time we were down there, I mean, we had, you know, you could see people you got very friendly with who got sick. So it was that period. I mean, looking at that wonderful, you know, the It's a Sin, you know, that series, you know,
wasn't it incredible?
We thought, gosh, some people are going to be seeing this as historical fiction, or they're going to be seeing it's period to them. This is our here and now that has suddenly come back to slam us in the face. Because at that point, I remember a few years into living in London, going off to, I was not somebody who would normally go to my American high school reunion because I had not felt very happy and as part of high school USA. And yet, for various reasons, I happened to be there for family reasons when there was the Livingston High School reunion. It was a New Jersey high school, you know, kind of New York suburbia. And, you know, other friends said, oh, come with us, come on, you know, we'll, it's going to be on while you're here visiting your parents, let's go. And went and was very happy to be saying to people, yes, I'm, you know, oh, I'm a lesbian, you know. And somebody jumped back. She said, oh, she said, does that mean you've got AIDS?
Wow.
Oh, God.
What do you say? You know.
Wow.
And there, you know, it was, but it was, yeah, I mean, that was a period where that wasn't historical fiction. It wasn't like watching, you know, Downton Abbey.
How are older and younger people linked, do you think, now in our community? How well are they linked?
Well, my own personal feelings are that that our community is obviously, I don't want to say based on, but what kind of, in the background all the time is sexuality, sex. People meet or traditionally met, I think, always in pubs, and in discos, clubs, and so on. And that isn't only just a gay space; it's also or an LGBT plus place. It's a mating game place. So when I hear people saying that there's ageism from younger LGBT people, I wonder if when they experience that, they come to an understanding that we are an ageist community, or whether they think, well, obviously, it's exactly the same everywhere. Of course, we have ageism in our community, but no more than anywhere else.
Would you agree with that, Ellen?
Yeah, I would think, well, ageism is again, one of the isms that have to be fought against. But, yeah, we live in an extremely ageist society. Capitalism, exactly. And what I refer to as metastasized capitalism, which is where I think we are now, is very much about commodification of people. And if you're old, you're kind of an expense rather than as a source of anything else. You know, you're not a hot property in quite the same way. You are marginalized. There's that young idealistic me that thinks people who we are all under the threat of all kinds of oppression, and again, we're all, you know, if we are all in the same boat, how can anybody who's experienced oppression about this become oppressive themselves and be bigoted or be discriminatory? And yet, it happens all the time in so many different layers of society. It's not just the queer world, as you say. I mean, the larger society is ageist. It used to be the population, the gay, queer, whatever, populations of Edinburgh and Glasgow were small enough. A, they overlapped a lot with each other, and B, people, they were smaller groups. You did tend to see people around more. No, now it's huge. There was a time when Scotland was a place, particularly urban Scotland, was a place that if you were lesbian or gay and you grew up here, and I know this not because I did grow up here, but from friends who did, you just left if you could. Mm. And now it's a place that people who are lesbian and gay might want to come too. But
I'm wondering how it feels for, you know, you talked about Edinburgh there and you know, Glasgow has that pull too, for sure. And, you know, I love hearing from friends that live on streets in Glasgow that are just occupied with, like, loads of queer people, just people kind of flocking to certain parts because it's probably, you know, just that sense of security around you. But I'm wondering how it feels for people outside the Central Belt, you know, people who are living in islands and highlands and rural Scotland.
And I remember there had been conferences. I don't know if they've had them lately. I remember speaking at one. Oh, what would that have been in the 80s, I guess, or in the 90s? You know, places like Inverness. I mean, there were get-togethers about issues about rural Scotland, you know, within the LGBT community. And, you know, there were all kinds of discussions and, you know, get-togethers and things like that. So I think I can't speak for it. I think things appear to be better in some ways. Just as an example, I mean, somebody recommended to my partner, because she loves gardening, that there's a really nice gardening program on BBC Alba, you know, the Gaelic-speaking one with subtitles. It's this lovely guy who is from Argyll, but he now lives in the West End of Glasgow with his male partner, and he's a gardener. And it's all about his gardening year, making the garden in, you know, the back green of his tenement and his front. And they keep going up to where the parents and the rest of the family hangs out.
I want to get him on the program.
It is a great. It is fabulous. I mean, I just can't remember what the name of it is. But it's okay. You know, and watching
the World Wide Web will help with that.
It's now gone into its second series, and so we were watching it. I was thinking things really have changed. If here's this guy, and it all happened. You know, the two of them together seem to be extremely fluent Gaelic speakers. And they're obviously from somewhere extremely rural, but they're now, you know, boys with a very green thumb somewhere in the West End of Glasgow. And it's, which is lovely, but
it's really
lovely. I'm not a rural person in any way. I mean, no. I had my little bit of tourism, as it were, into fishing village life. But
I was just thinking about the kind of migration of people and you know, needing to find spaces and safety and being able to have your pride moments, you know, without necessarily people that you know knowing you're there. I think that must happen still at pride marches.
Well, I think I used to have this theory, yeah, I must have been from an undergraduate anthropology course, of queer transhumance, the migration in order to get far enough away from your parents or your family or your community to be able to come out. I mean, I had to leave the narrow provincialism of the New York metropolitan area to come to the bright lights of Edinburgh before I could come out.
Wow, I would have thought it'd been the other way around.
Well, it was for other people. I have a friend who was from here.
But your family's there, so I suppose that's the point, right?
Yeah.
It's sometimes
you have
these
to come away from where you're from.
Prisons
you
that we have
then.
Around us.
Maybe that's like, I don't think this guy, this lovely gardener, is the Gaelic-speaking gardener, who's, you know, maybe he hasn't had to do it because he's of a much younger generation. Back then, you kind of had to go somewhere else.
Coming to Scotland as an adult, it was... I just felt like coming home, and I've never ever changed. So I'm really happy to be here. I mean, there were so many good things going on at the moment. But can I just come back briefly to the ageism thing? I think that we have great opportunities in the LGBT community for that. And I think I was for a while part of Loud and Proud Choir.
Yes,
and
yeah.
That was a really
really intergenerational space.
Because, yes, it's absolutely. It's intergenerational. And I think that was perhaps obvious, but it's also an absolute joy.
I'm involved with a basketball group, an LGBT basketball group. And that is also a space where we've got, you know, people of different generations playing and together. To get that sense of community, to come with your own ambitions with it or your own interests, different levels of fitness, different levels of skill, but still come and do something together in the same space and learn from each other.
Yeah.
And I see it happening with basketball, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And I know that it happens with Loud and Proud as well.
Yeah. I think that we've got to be careful, though, with LGBT communities here in Scotland and everywhere else. I don't know if you were listening to the programme that starts in the morning on Radio Scotland, Kay's phone-in programme.
Is it Kay Adams?
Kay Adams, that's right. She was actually extremely surprised by the first few contributions she got, as I was delighted by them in a way, because the question was, is Scotland a racist community? Is Scotland a racist society? And the very clear answer within I mean, 20 minutes of the programme starting, it was clear that it is. Yeah. And that's something that I think that people in the gay community have to be very, very, very careful of, because we need to understand that in order to properly integrate ourselves, we need to be aware of our own diversity.
Mm.
And we need to be aware of the diversity in the community around us. I think organisations of any kind, you have to be ready for integration. You have to be ready for diversity as organisations. And I think that's something that LGBT organisations should particularly look towards.
If you love celebrating and learning about queer life in Scotland, you are going to love Somewhere for Us magazine. It's a sumptuous feast of LGBTQ+ arts, culture, heritage and enterprise, featuring music icons like Joan Armatrading, Horse McDonald and Big Frida. Award-winning authors like Douglas Stewart, Val McDermid, and groundbreaking actors like Annie Wallace. Every issue is beautifully illustrated, bursting with pride and love for Scottish queer life. So visit somewhereforus.org, become a member, and be part of Somewhere for Us.
So Somewhere for Us, the magazine and the podcast, champion arts, culture, heritage and enterprise. That's what we're all about. What would you like to champion as hugely valued and celebrated members of our LGBT community?
We're talking about championing. My big interest at the moment, and it's maybe a selfish one, is older LGBT people and their experience of aging and perhaps approaching a time when they're going into care of some kind. The Scottish government's working at the moment, and they had this wonderful statement of intent that says, we want to make Scotland the best place in the world to grow old. And what we're doing at the moment through our wonderful organisations like LGBT Health is to actually, well, tomorrow actually, I'm speaking to, with lots of other people, government representatives, and to say, look, we want it to apply to us as well. And this is what you need to do, and you need to do it soon. That's just such a rewarding thing. It's such a rewarding thing to be involved in. And that's what I try and champion. But of course, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. I know that.
And not to harp on about the patriarchy, but because the patriarchy defines society in a binary way, it has defined services for women and it's defined services for men. It's defined how you treat women who are older and defined how you treat men who are older, what you have available to you, what you have access to, what kind of supports you have, what kind of healthcare you receive. Everything is defined by this divided structure of a binary structure, which doesn't actually serve or support LGBTQ plus people at all, whether you're trans or non-binary or cisgender within the community. It doesn't serve anyone in society, but particularly for LGBTQ plus people. And going back to this argument about the division and toxicity around people's belief systems, in my opinion and in my experience of every trans person I know, that division is so unhelpful to the progress of every single person in our community.
It's absolutely toxic. And where did it come? You know, you think, well, where did it come from? I mean, you know, I just think it's part of my, you know, I know it is so easy in this globally to think in terms of the conspiratorial images, the metaphor of everything as conspiracy, whether it is things going on in American politics to do with Trump or whether it's to do with vaccination anywhere in the world, that there people are feeling on some levels so powerless or disempowered that it's a very, very easy response is to think, well, somebody
there's
somewhere.
There's anger, but it's being it's directed anger. In the wrong
and
way.
And it's a kind of, it's that sense of, that maybe it is a reflection of powerlessness and or that people who feel either disempowered or never had the power in the first place. Just that sense that things are so awry, that where do you start or where do you pause? And, you know, how, in terms of how does one revise, recalibrate, I don't know. You can't go back to the past and say, well, things were better then, or there was a moment when there was some sort of golden age of sympathy and understanding and solidarity. But where do you find the tools for now? Because now, for on so many levels, is so hideous. I mean, you can't look, you know, you can't look at the news in the morning without thinking, you know, you've got people being the phenomenal racism in terms of the way immigration is dealt with, the way the support for struggles elsewhere in the world are dealt with. Things, there are so many things that both connect and disconnect us that, you know, it's sort of hard to know.
It is a time for a hugely important time for solidarity. You could argue it's more important than it has ever been. You know, where are we getting it right for older LGBTQ plus people? Where are those spaces? Where do you find that those places? Because it's very tempting to say, here's an event for older people and here you can come and meet people of your age. And that's hugely important to connect. But there also needs to be a solidarity within the community between genders, between sexualities, between age, you know, between ethnicities?
I think we need to see, I think we need to try and evolve those things. I think they're missing at the moment almost entirely. Of course, it's lovely to see older people on pride marches. It's lovely to see the provision of buses for people on pride marches. But it doesn't go far enough. And
where would you take it?
Well, as I've hinted before, I think we have to be, for instance, ready for to be welcoming to any people from the BME community that come along. I think we have to be more welcoming to people outside our community, from people in the closet to allies to come in. I think we need to push the boundaries all the time, because it's just not a place for instance, and in my experience, older people to be able to, are given the space, except amongst themselves, to share stories and history and our pride.
What would you like the younger folks to know about ageing in the LGBTQ plus community?
I would like to say, listen, we left behind us a much better place for you guys.
we are going to
make older living for LGBT people better, and we'll leave that for you guys too. Partly tongue in cheek, but partly not. That's what I'd like to say to them. Let's keep on fighting the battle. Let's choose the hills to die on. Let's choose where our strength lies as individuals to try and make a difference. And it all adds together in the end.
Thank you, Tim. What about you, Ellen? What would you say to a 32-year-old attending their first Pride this year?
Attending their first Pride? I would say, if you're 32 and you're attending your first Pride this year, then you've had a much harder, longer struggle than a lot of your contemporaries. And yet it is always, for some people and from some places, it will be an uphill struggle, and the timelines are not identical. We don't all march in lockstep. So I don't know, I've often thought, I don't, you know, there's things about talk to your past self, or, you know, in some ways, I mean, one is forever living multiply, you know, simultaneously in the past, the present, and the future, and shuttling frantically back and forth, in my case, even to generations before myself that I'm constantly in conversation with in a very strange way. I guess the thing I would say is, you know, people don't stop being interesting or have stuff you might like to talk to them about just because we're no longer fit to run up and down from, you know, the bottom of Broughton Street to the far end of the meadows without stopping to
I have never done that, actually, just so you know.
No, I think the thing is, don't make assumptions about people just because they're old. I mean, it infuriates me when I say, oh, but it was all those older people who voted for Brexit, or all those older people who voted for this and that. Well, I didn't know any of them. Or, you know, I think the only person I know who, something that the older accused of having supported, the only person I know who actually voted in that direction was somebody who was a whippersnapper in their 40s.
Well, there you go.
I don't know any oldies whose values were that far to the right.
Mm. That's really important. Thank you, Ellen.
And that's one of the joys of living in Scotland.
I think so.
I'm going to end on this question. What does the word love evoke for you right now?
Hope. Fear, anxiety, gratitude, enthusiasm, connection, and much bigger and much more in miniature than you would imagine all at the same time. It is a very delicious heap of contradictions, and it's just something everybody should have and everybody should feel. And, you know, it's like having enough food. Everybody should have the right to it and the ability to get it and give it.
Lovely. What about you, Tim?
I think it's just such a massive word that it's very difficult to be absolutely clear. But for me, it goes from my arms around another man and feeling strong emotional and physical links with them, right down, right, no, I'm not saying down, for goodness sake, right through to...
Could be down.
I don't think it's down. I certainly didn't mean to say that. Anyway, to my friends, whether they're in the LGBT plus community or not, to my own very dear family, to the ravens that I go up Arthur's Seat to watch and see if they've had babies yet this year. I mean, it is just such a huge thing. They have had babies this year, by the way. I think my understanding of love has broadened a lot since I was when I was young, which was probably just arms around a man, please, kind of thing. But no, it's I love our community, and it's kind of hard to pick one thing, really, not to love about where I am and where we are, and you guys, and the whole of the whole of Scotland.
And I feel that off you, Tim. I feel it off you.
Really,
I really do.
For you to say
it too. I do. I really feel it. I feel it off you both. Yeah, you've both taught me a lot today, that language, love. One other thing I'd just like to add about the word love, I think, which doesn't happen enough for everybody that I know, with or without the LGBTQ plus community, is self-love and learning to really love ourselves, forgive ourselves, accept ourselves. And I think that's something I'm still learning. And with that, I bid you self-love and to go and commit to some self-love. And why not?
And why not? And thank you so much for this. It's been such a joy.
I'm so grateful to you both. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Yeah.
And thank you both.
Thanks so much for listening to me, Jules, and the Somewhere For Us podcast. And we have a lot more to come. Check out our podcast website, somewhereforus.org/podcast, where you'll get all the details on who we're talking to and how to listen to each episode. You can join us as a member to receive your copy of the quarterly magazine as soon as it's hot off the press. And if you do, 20% of your membership goes straight into the Somewhere Arts and Culture Fund and the Somewhere Enterprise and Research Fund. Members get a thank you on our supporters page in the magazine and lots more besides. So visit somewhereforus.org to find out more.